Good morning again. So here we are, week three of the story, and probably one, if you grew up in church, you probably heard it. Even if you didn't grow up in church, you may well have heard this story. I know several of you well enough to know that you have hopes, you have dreams, you have plans. Maybe for a career, for relationships, for things that you might experience, for that your life might make a difference, maybe, in somebody else's life to some degree at least, or that you might advance God's kingdom in some way. And right now, you're all no doubt in different places with respect to those hopes and dreams and plans. Some of you are in places where you can see the hand of God in your life. You can feel the wind of the Spirit in your sails, and you're full of hope. You're moving forward, and you feel like you're moving in the direction that you're called to go. Some of you can look back and see that your life wasn't exactly what you thought it would be, or perhaps not at all what you thought it would be, but you can see in retrospect that the way that God steered you was maybe a little bit better than you could have imagined. Some of you are disappointed. Some of you are frustrated. You feel cheated. The relationship didn't work out. You didn't get the job or the promotion. Your health's holding you back. And as we pursue various things in life, the journey often feels more like a roller coaster than a direct flight, doesn't it? And I love roller coasters, but not necessarily in life. There are so many ups and downs in life. There's hidden curves. There's even loop-the-loops where you don't know which direction you're going. Sometimes you feel like your life is going somewhere good, and sometimes you wonder if you're just stumbling along randomly as life happens around you and to you. So last week, we heard how God told Abraham and Sarah to go and be a blessing. And they went, and they blessed. Their obedience in following and trusting God turned into this huge vehicle that God could use for blessing the whole world. Much of it long after they were dead and gone. They didn't get to see it. They didn't see much of the nation that God promised to build from their family. They only saw one son. That was it. They certainly didn't get to see the one descendant this nation would ultimately produce that would bless the entire world. And of course, that's Jesus. But they did what God called them to do, albeit with a few stumbles, and they trusted that God would do what he promised he would do. So this week is about Joseph, Abraham and Sarah's great-grandson. If you think about it, you know, Abraham had Isaac, right? And then Isaac had Jacob and Esau, and Joseph was one of Jacob's sons, so he's great-grandson. Most people have heard of at least part of this story, even if it's just that you saw the 1970s musical. It did have a comeback recently, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Anybody seen that? You familiar? Am I speaking Chinese? No? Anyway, it's good. It's kind of fun. There's all sorts of clips on YouTube. You could go watch it. And it was actually fairly accurate to the story, if you saw that, which is good. Many of you probably read the chapter 3 in the story this week leading up to this, if you're following along with us. So if the story of Abraham and Sarah showed us that nobody is too old to have a significant role in God's story, then Joseph's story shows us, among other things, that you're never too young to have a significant role in God's story. It's important to remember we have the benefit of reading Joseph's story all at once. You sit down, you read the whole chapter. Or if you read it in the Bible, it's actually 14 chapters. But you can sit down and you can read it all in one go. And when you read it for the second or the third or the umpteenth time, you know there's going to be a great ending, a happy ending, right? But it's helpful for us to think that as we read about it, how much time went by in that story. Joseph was 17 years old when his troubles really began. And he had 22 years of struggle. He didn't get to turn the page and see the happy ending right away. And he didn't even know if there would be any kind of happy ending. Now, I know some of you are in that 17 to 39 window, so maybe you can relate. But even if you're outside that window, that isn't necessarily the timeline for the struggle. Perhaps more than any other story in the Bible, Joseph's life is a great example of what's happening in the daily reality of our lower story, right? And the fact that it doesn't necessarily reflect what God's up to in his big eternal upper story. So Joseph rides this roller coaster of good times, bad times, mediocre times, really bad times, really great times. And sometimes it just looks like God's just gone. He's just not there at all. Certainly doesn't care about his personal suffering and the unjust treatment that he's receiving. But he doesn't waver in his commitment to God and entrusting his life to him. And in the end, he looks back and he sees how God had a much bigger purpose. And his decades of affliction were part of something definitely more important and worthwhile. So what we're going to do this morning is, first of all, we're going to walk through the lower story of Joseph's life, and we're going to do kind of a how's it going meter at each point in the story. And then we're going to take a look at what was going on, or at least what we know and can see of what was going on in the upper story. So the story starts in Genesis chapter 37. It actually occupies more than a fourth of the book of Genesis. This is a big story. And yes, we're going to cover the whole thing this morning. You ready? So Joseph was Jacob's favorite son, partly because he was born when Jacob was fairly old, so he was delighted to have a son in his old age, but partly because he was the son of his favorite wife. If you remember Jacob, I don't know that this part was in the story book, but you may have read it. Jacob was working for his father-in-law Laban to earn Rachel because he loved her, and Laban did the switcheroo. You have to be really careful who you marry if she's wearing a veil. Make sure the veil goes up before you say, I do, because he didn't get Rachel, he got Leah. So Leah produced lots of sons, and then he had to wait another 7 years to get Rachel, and then he did eventually get Rachel. But Rachel was the wife that he really loved. So Joseph was the first son of Rachel and was very special to him. So he made no secret of the fact that Joseph was his favorite son. He loved Joseph more than the other brothers, and he gave him this really special robe. What do we know about Joseph's robe? It had many colors. Well, we think we know that. Actually, that little phrase might just mean it was a robe of long sleeves. A little disappointing. We've got to redo all the children's books because it doesn't necessarily have many colors, but we know it is a robe of many colors. Maybe it was. But anyway, robes were a big deal. When your dad gave you a robe, it said you belong in the family. It's protection. It's honor. That was kind of a big deal. So, of course, did his brothers like this? No. Okay, Dad, we're brothers too. We're older. Where's the love? This little upstart, you like him so much? They're so hurt and angry, they couldn't even have a peaceful conversation with him. And then Joseph has this dream of his brothers represented by sheaves of wheat, like there's 10, 11 sheaves of wheat, and his sheaf of wheat, and their 11 sheaves of wheat are bowing down to his sheaf of wheat. And he told his brothers about this dream. May not have been the smartest move. Then he had another dream of the sun and moon and 11 stars bowing down to his star. And that one earned a sharp rebuke by his father. He's like, really? You really think your mother and I and all your brothers are going to bow down to you, Joseph? I love you. I love you a lot. But so the brothers are jealous, but not the greatest start here. So how are things going at this point? He's loved by dad. He's hated by his brothers. There's no peace in the family. So then, further on in chapter 37, this family are shepherds. They've got goats. They've got sheep, herds. So they send Jacob sends Joseph out to check on his brothers and the herds and see how they're doing. So they see Joseph coming from a long way off, which would add strength to the fact that maybe it was a robe of many colors because they could see him from a long way off. And they're like, this is our chance. We can get rid of him. That annoying little brother, we can just murder him, get rid of him right here. That's how much they hated him. Reuben, apparently one of his older brothers, had a bit of a conscience, and he said, no, let's just put him in a pit, and he has a secret plan to rescue him later. But in the meantime, a whole caravan of Ishmaelites, right? Remember Ishmael? We've already mentioned him this morning. That was the other son of Abraham, Ishmael, that he had with Hagar. And, you know, it's interesting because they come along, they're second cousins apparently, but there's clearly no relationship. Anyway, they think, well, we'll just sell Joseph to these Ishmaelite traders. So he is human trafficked, basically. They deceive Jacob into thinking that Joseph is dead. They kill an animal, and they soak the robe in the animal's blood so that it'll look like an animal tore him to shreds. And Jacob is just devastated and inconsolable. Joseph gets sold to a man named Potiphar in Egypt. He's the captain of Pharaoh's guard. So how are things going here? At least he wasn't murdered. There's hope while you've still got breath, right? But he's been sold as a slave to foreigners. His dad thinks he's dead. He's got no cell phone. He's got no legal system to appeal to. He's got no international human rights. Looks pretty hopeless. So it goes on in chapter 39, and it says, the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. Even in that awful situation, he has success. He has favor. He's promoted to be overseer of Potiphar's house. He's in charge of everything. And the Lord even blessed Potiphar because he was there. So how are things going here? Well, relatively speaking, they're going pretty well. He's still a slave, but he's got responsibility. He's got success. He's getting a little respect. We go on in chapter 39. The plot thickens. Potiphar's wife is a little bored. We have a little desperate housewife situation going on here, and she thinks that Joseph, who the Bible actually tells us was handsome in form and appearance, and so she thinks that he would be a little fun in her life, so she starts flirting with him and tempting him. He says, no, absolutely not. I won't do this wickedness. I'm not going to betray my master's trust, and he won't listen to her. Well, she's mad. She's probably hurt, maybe a little embarrassed. She's not used to people telling her no. So she wrongly accuses him of trying to rape her. And, of course, when the master comes home and she tells him this, he thinks, Joseph, I've given you everything. You have to take my wife as well. And he throws him in prison. How are things going now? Well, this is a pretty deep dip in the roller coaster. It's unjust, it's undeserved, it's unpleasant. Egyptian prisons certainly were not anywhere that you wanted to be. He's got no recourse, he's got no resources, he's got no advocates to help get him out. But we read in Genesis 39:21, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. So how are things going now? Even in prison, he's given favor, responsibility, success, and respect. In chapter 40, we see a ray of hope. He correctly interprets the dreams that Pharaoh's cupbearer and his chief baker, they had been thrown into prison, who knows why, but they had had dreams, and Joseph interprets the dreams correctly, that the cupbearer would be restored to his position and the baker would be beheaded. So he interprets these dreams for them. He gives credit to God. He says, do not interpretations belong to God? He's still got this tremendous confidence in God, and he gives him credit. It's very, maybe he was beginning to learn a little humility. I don't know. Definitely honorable. He's also kind of shrewd. He looks for an opportunity here for justice. And so he says in chapter 40, verse 14, he says to the cupbearer, only remember me when it's well with you. And please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit. Well, the cupbearer promptly forgot Joseph. And so how are things going? Things are going absolutely nowhere. His big hope of someone putting in a good word for him fades to nothing. 2 years later. 2 more years. Have you ever had something like that happen? You get a ray of hope, and then nothing. 700 days. Pharaoh then has dreams. Now, if you've seen the musical, Pharaoh is portrayed as Elvis' character. I could sing it for you, but maybe I won't. So anyway, it's very fun. Do look that one up on YouTube. Look up Pharaoh's Dream from Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, because it's very funny. But anyway, that probably was not how it played out in the actual story. But Pharaoh had some dreams, and nobody in his kingdom could interpret these dreams. He was very perplexed by them. And suddenly the cupbearer remembers Joseph, who correctly interpreted his dreams. So he tells Pharaoh about him. They bring Joseph out of prison. I love the little details the Bible puts in. He gets to shave and change his clothes. So it's kind of fun. Anyway, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it's not me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. I love that he continually gives God credit. So Joseph tells Pharaoh that there'll be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine, and he tells him to find a discerning and wise man to oversee collecting one-fifth of the extra produce in the plentiful years and store it away for the famine. What I love here is that Pharaoh sees God's spirit in Joseph. This is pagan Pharaoh. He says, and Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there's none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. So he puts him second in command. It's amazing that Pharaoh does this before any of the dream interpretation comes true. Joseph's own dreams of his brothers bowing to him haven't come true yet. The one about the cupbearer and the baker did, but wow, I don't know. Somehow, though, for Pharaoh, all this rings true. No doubt he was under the influence of God's spirit. So he gives Joseph a signet ring, which is basically a rubber stamp. You can sign into law whatever you deem is appropriate. He gives him fine linen garments. He gives him a gold chain. See, they were in Egypt as well as in the 70s here. And he gives him his second chariot. Everybody has to pay homage to him. He's got authority. He's given a wife. If I was Joseph, though, to be honest, I'd be sweating a little. I'd be thinking, oh, God, that interpretation you gave me better be right. Otherwise, I'm really in trouble here. And at this point, he's 30 years old. This is 13 years after he was sold into slavery at age 17. So how are things going? Suddenly, everything's changed. His fortunes have turned. From the lowest low in the prison and completely forgotten and having no hope to being second in command of the nation of Egypt. Wow. And even Pharaoh recognizes that God's spirit is with him. So this roller coaster has become one of those rapid elevators. You know the ones that go up 40 floors in a few seconds and they leave your stomach down there? You have to catch it later. Right. So in chapter 41, the dream interpretations do in fact come true. They have 7 years of bumper crops, and Joseph gathers up the extra food. In the meantime, he has 2 sons. And then there is, following that, famine in Egypt and all the surrounding nations in the ancient Near East. And everyone's going to Joseph for grain. So how are things going here? Very well. The interpretation God gave him was right on. He's been able to set up systems for storage and distribution of food. He made Pharaoh very rich because now everybody's coming to buy grain from Pharaoh's stores. And eventually, when their money runs out, they sell their animals to Pharaoh. They sell themselves to Pharaoh as slaves. So Pharaoh is gaining wealth. He's gaining control. he is very happy with Joseph. Of course, now, meanwhile, back in Canaan, Jacob and his family and all Joseph's brothers are starting to get hungry. They have nothing to eat. So Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to buy grain, all except the youngest one, Benjamin. That was the other son of his favorite wife, and he'd lost one. He didn't want to lose the other one. So he sends the 10 sons off to buy grain. And what do the brothers do when they arrive? They bow down to the man in charge, Joseph. They didn't recognize him, obviously, and he pretends not to recognize them. And he accuses them of being spies. He imprisons them for 3 days, and he keeps Simeon, one of the older brothers, in custody and demands that if they come back, they better bring their youngest brother, Benjamin. Otherwise, they're not getting Simeon back, and they're not getting any more grain. So they return to Jacob, and they're actually horrified to find that the money that they paid for the grain has been returned in their sacks. So that really fills them with fear. You know, if we go back, are we going to be accused of stealing and all this? And Jacob refuses to let Benjamin go. So they're really afraid. What are we going to do? So how are things going now? Finally, Joseph's earlier dream had come true after over 20 years. And you can feel this tension. Joseph starts to make his brothers sweat a little. Is he going to stick it to them and get revenge? You do get a little hint that he has a soft heart when it talks about him having to leave the room to weep because he's so overcome with emotion when he sees them. But Joseph's still separated from his family, and they seem to just leave Simeon in jail in Egypt. So is he testing them to see whether they've changed? The famine is severe. So Jacob eventually decides that he will have to send his sons back to get more grain, and he will have to send Benjamin. Judah talks him into it by saying, I pledge his safety. I will be responsible for him. And they load up their animals with as many gifts as they could come up with. It's interesting. It talks about pistachios and almonds. And in the past, I've thought, if you're in a famine, why have you got pistachios and almonds? But you know, Craig has family in California, and in the Fresno Valley, where they used to grow all these vegetables and crops and everything, there's such a drought now, everybody has gone to growing almonds and pistachios. It's like, oh, that's what you grow in a drought. But you can't live on pistachios and almonds, right? They make a nice gift, but yeah. So anyway, once again, they come, they confess that the money was put back in their sacks when they went back. And the doorman says, I don't know what you're talking about. God must have done that. And they're like, oh. You know, you have to think in their shoes. They'd be thinking, what is going on here? They bow to Joseph once again. They give him the presents. And Joseph orders a feast. And he is so overcome with emotion that he has to leave once again to weep. So he sent them back again to Jacob with food, and once again the money was returned in their sacks, but also this time he planted his silver cup in Benjamin's sack. And when Joseph's servants chase after them and find the cup, the brothers are just terrified, because the punishment that is ordered is that Benjamin will be punished by death for having taken Joseph's silver cup. Judah pleads to replace his brother because he promised his dad. He says, take me instead of Benjamin, because he doesn't want their father to die of grief at losing two favorite sons. So how are things going? Joseph's totally in control, isn't he? He has the power to get revenge or to bless. The brothers are completely at his mercy at this point. And we read here that, yes, Joseph is in control, but he loses control. He has to send all the Egyptians away, and he privately reveals who he is to his brothers. And this is, you can just imagine, you know, you've seen the little reunions when a soldier comes back, you know, you've seen the clips on YouTube or whatever, or on Facebook. Can you imagine what this was like after over 20 years? So this is a really awesome moment. It's awesome, though, because of what Joseph says and the way he handles it. He says, and now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For For God sent me here before you to preserve life. And God sent me before you to preserve you, for you, a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. So you can imagine they have a huge sigh of relief at Joseph's forgiveness and mercy towards them. And so Joseph instructs them to bring Jacob and all of the family, all their possessions up to Egypt. Pharaoh blesses this. He gives them carts to go and get everything. And so the brothers go back. And I love the little line that Joseph throws in there. Do not quarrel on the way. They're still brothers. It takes some time for Jacob to believe the brothers when they go back. You know, you think it's been 2 decades he believes that his son is dead. But finally they're able to convince Jacob that this is true. And so Israel, Jacob's name is now Israel, he and the entire family go to Egypt. And this is now 70 people. Joseph and Jacob are reunited. Beautiful. So how's things going? Joseph's dreams have come true. He's reconciled with his family in a way that he could never have brought about by himself. He's ridden the roller coaster for 22 years, even without knowing that his family would eventually come back together. He was trusting God without knowing that outcome. And the way that he was able to forgive his brothers allows reconciliation and a reuniting of the family. And provision for his family, this family that's going to become this nation of Israel, God's special nation. His recognition that there's more to the story than the unfair way that he's been treated and his hard life. His submission to God acknowledges that there's a bigger picture, that God has this upper story. And he's able to bring the Israelites, all 12 of Jacob's sons and their families, to Goshen, which was a really good part of the land in Egypt. And it's a place where they can multiply, where they can have plenty of food and have a good life there. So we've got a happy ending. We've got 22 years of hardship, followed by 71 years of peace and prosperity with his family, because we read it, that the Bible tells us that he died at 110. The story isn't quite over because Jacob dies, and in chapter 50, the brothers, the last chapter of Genesis, the brothers pretend that their father had commanded them, commanded Joseph to forgive them. And Joseph weeps at this. And there's this moment where they fall down and they say, Joseph, we'll be your servants. They're obviously still kind of afraid of him. And he says, Joseph says in response in chapter 50, verse 19, he says, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive. So how are things going? Well, it's sad that the brothers are still living with shame and fear because of their earlier sin. And we don't know. Does Joseph weep because of his father's request, if he believes that the request did in fact come from him, that he should forgive his brothers? Or is he weeping because his brothers are still lying, if he knows the request didn't come from Jacob? Is he weeping because they're still living in shame? Or because of his desire to have full trust between him and his brothers and restoration? We don't know. We just see his tender heart. At the end of the story, we would all agree that Joseph got to play a major role in God's story. Because of his character, his attitude, his outlook, he was perfectly cast to play such an important role. And we can read the story in its entirety in just absolute awe of how God used every twist and turn, even the brothers' sin and betrayal, to accomplish his bigger purposes. Joseph never faltered. He was true and faithful to God's calling in his life in every situation. Whether he was head of an influential household or in charge of other prisoners or second only to Pharaoh. In spite of every negative circumstance, the separation from his family, being sold as a slave, being wrongly accused, being in prison, this decades-long timeline, He didn't know the final outcome of the Lois story, but he trusted God and he remained faithful and he always credited God for his successes. So we can look back at this story. We can see a godly man who survived adversity, held on to hope, remained faithful, rode the roller coaster, and experienced God's favor along the way, which even extended to everyone around him and those that he served and those that he led. And ultimately, he saw God come through for him and his family in an amazing way. But we also want to look at the upper story. What was God really up to in all of this as we step back? And the Bible gives us two perspectives on what God was doing in the upper story throughout Joseph's life. One of them's in the New Testament. It's always great when the New Testament looks back at Old Testament stories and has more perspective and a little insight. Last week, from Hebrews 11 and James and Romans, Craig showed us how that New Testament writers had perspective looking back on Abraham. The New Testament writers, that they've got the Spirit in them. They can look back and look at the Old Testament scriptures in a whole new light and see the bigger picture. And they can provide commentary and clues to what's going on in that upper story. So there are a couple of verses in Acts 7. This is a speech that Stephen gave when he was defending his faith to the synagogue rulers. This is after Jesus has died and resurrected. The church is just getting started, and they're starting to get a lot of persecution and opposition. And Stephen is standing before the synagogue rulers and the religious leaders who are threatened by this new religion, new faith, and they're ultimately going to stone him to death. But we have this amazing sermon, basically, that Stephen preached. And he looks back on God's story throughout the Old Testament and sees how it was pointing to Jesus coming to save us. And this is what he says about Joseph. This is Acts 7, 9 to 10. He says, and the patriarchs were Joseph and his 11 brothers, the 12 of them that became the 12 tribes of Israel. The patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt, but God was with him and rescued him out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who made him ruler over Egypt and over all his household. There are four things here. There's four principles of God's upper story that apply to Joseph, but they also apply to us. God was with Joseph, he's with us. He rescued Joseph, he rescues us. He gave him favor, he gives us favor, and he gave him wisdom, he gives us wisdom. So we're going to look at those. God was with Joseph. God was working. He was working in and through all the circumstances of Joseph's life, every hardship, every disappointment, every honor and success, every pitch up and down of the roller coaster. And he was working in and through his character. Every choice to honor God and honor his masters, every time that he gave God the credit for his abilities and his genuine forgiveness of his brothers, we see God working through Joseph's character. God was with him in every circumstance and every choice. He hadn't abandoned him. Even when it looked like it in the moment, God was right there helping him, protecting him, orchestrating events towards divine conclusions. Joseph remained faithful and he chose to believe that God was with him, even when that faithfulness was challenged in some extreme ways. And God's with us. It's not just a warm, fuzzy feeling of God holding your hand, sympathizing with you emotionally, weeping with you when you weep, and rejoicing with you when you're happy, and telling you I love you. It is that, but it's more than that. He's with you. He's with your story. Your story is part of his story. He cast you in your role, and he's the ultimate director. He's coaching you through it. In Matthew 28, the second half of verse 20, Jesus is leaving the earth physically. It's after the resurrection. He's going back up to be with his Father in heaven, and he says, and behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. course, he won't be with them physically, but he reassures them of his remaining presence through his Spirit. In John 14, verses 16 to 17, Jesus said, I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper to be with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. God's Spirit is with us. He's so with us that he's actually in us, helping us and guiding us and empowering us from inside. So whatever you go through in life, God is with you. Jesus is with you. He's right there with you by his Spirit. You're not alone. He's not absent. He's involved. If you're following him, whether it looks like it or not, whether you can see his fingerprints or not, whether you feel him or not, he's there. He's with you and in you. We also see that God rescued Joseph. There are several points in the story where you'd look at it and in that moment and say, he did not rescue him. But in the big picture, he rescued not only Joseph, but the whole nation and even the surrounding nations. He rescued his life. Yeah, he was put into slavery for quite a long time, but he wasn't murdered. And while there's breath, there's hope, right? He rescued his reputation. He was falsely accused, but he ended up being given responsibility and positions of power and trust. And he rescued his family relationships through his forgiveness and his reconciliation. And God rescues us. Again, it doesn't always look like God is rescuing us in that moment, or even in that year or that decade, when we lose a job, when we have health problems, when we're struggling in relationships, or we feel betrayed or unjustly treated, when we feel like everything that we do fails. But God's rescue is more important than that. It's bigger than that. God will sometimes rescue us in our specific circumstances. He rescued Paul from shipwrecks and beating and robbers, as well as from false teachers and people who challenged his message and his integrity. But in Colossians 1, verses 13 and 14, Paul describes God's ultimate rescue. It says, he has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. God has rescued us from the power of sin and death in our lives. Our sins are forgiven, and our citizenship has been transferred from belonging to the domain of darkness, which is ruled by the devil, to citizenship in his kingdom. That's a rescue. And God gave Joseph favor. Did you notice that everywhere that Joseph went, the story tells us he had favor with people of influence? He was Joseph's favorite son. Potiphar put him in charge of the house. The prison guard put him in charge of everything in the prison. And Pharaoh put him in charge of the entire nation. He was second only to Pharaoh himself. That wasn't favor that he brought on himself. It was God's blessing in his life. Sure, he had good character, and he proved himself trustworthy and capable. But there was also a lot that was totally out of his control that could only be attributed to God's goodness towards him. God gives us favor too. In Luke 4, verses 18 and 19, Jesus is quoting the prophet Isaiah, and he says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives. There's rescue there too. And recovering sight of the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, more rescue, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. God had promised through the prophet Isaiah that a time would come when his people would live in relationship with him and experience his favor. And Jesus quoted that in Luke and said, the time is now. This is the time. That year that he says, the year of the Lord's favor, isn't a literal year. It's a time. God's favor is here. It's now. You have God's favor. If we choose to repent of our sins and follow God, we have his favor. We get to live in relationship with God. We get to do life with his Spirit. If that's not favor, what is? That's the best kind of favor. And we can expect God's favor in our lives now, not just in eternity after we die, not the kind of favor that makes everything easy and rosy, but the kind of favor where God surprises us, makes connections that we couldn't make, gives us influence where people come into contact with us are blessed because of us. So where's God given you favor? Where has he given you influence or opportunities or blessings? Perhaps you have favor with your employer or with a teacher, or God gives you an open door to share your testimony or pray for someone, or something good or fun happens that you know only God could have orchestrated and known that that would be meaningful for you. If we don't expect it, we may not notice it, but we are living in the time of God's favor. So let's expect it and look for it and appreciate God's favor in our lives. And then God gave Joseph wisdom. God gave Joseph incredible wisdom, not necessarily in telling his family his dreams. That wasn't necessarily the wisest move, but in running Potiphar's household, in staying righteous, in organizing prisoners, in administering famine prevention. God gave him strategy and systems. God blessed him and blessed everyone connected with him because of the wise way that he conducted his life and exercised his leadership. God gives us wisdom too. In James 1 verse 5, it says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. I don't know about you. I don't always feel particularly wise. I don't always know what I should do. Wisdom's more than knowledge, isn't it? It's using good judgment. It's making sound decisions. It's being able to see past what might feel good in this moment to understanding the impact that our decisions might have down the road and on other people. Most people who are wise gain their wisdom by experience, but God can give us wisdom completely directly, not necessarily from the school of hard knocks. And James says that he gives us wisdom without reproach. He won't make you feel stupid for needing to ask for wisdom. He'll give us wisdom, either directly or through wise people around us when we ask for it. So we can see in the upper story that God was with Joseph all the time. He rescued him more than once. He gave him favor. He gave him wisdom. And he's with us. He rescues us. He gives us favor and wisdom. The other place the Bible gives us a window into the upper story is Joseph's own perspective. We already read a little bit of this in Genesis 45, but I want to read it again. It says, this is Joseph speaking. He says to his brothers, and now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, meaning an advisor to Pharaoh, and the Lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. And then again, after Jacob dies in chapter 50, he says his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So two things. He realizes God sent him. All these twists and turns weren't random. His brothers intended evil, to harm him, to make him suffer, to get rid of him. And it did cause great suffering for Joseph. He was sold as a slave. He was separated from his family. It caused great suffering for Jacob. He had the grief of thinking that his favorite son was dead for over 20 years. And it even caused suffering for his brothers, who carried that guilt and that shame for what they had done. They plotted evil. They sent him away to get rid of him. But God was in control to send him to Egypt for good purposes. They were going to kill him, but God worked the situation so that he became a slave instead of being murdered. He orchestrated the household he served in as a slave and even used his wrongful accusation and imprisonment to bring him into Pharaoh's service. Every detail of the story, whether it was intended by God or not, was used by God. From Joseph's original dreams to seeing his dreams come true as his brothers are bowing before him. And I doubt that any of it looked like what he thought it would look like and what he dreamed as a 17-year-old. But Joseph knew that he was sent by God, that the events of his life were ordered by God. And we're sent too. John 20:21, Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I'm sending you." God sends you and me into the world to represent him and to make him known. What a difference it makes in our lives if we know that we are sent. God sends us into a world that doesn't know him yet to make him known. So let's be sent. Let's go be a blessing, as we heard last week with Abraham and Sarah. And God had a purpose. Jacob could see that God had sent him to Egypt to keep the nation of Israel alive through the famine, to preserve this remnant that would ultimately become this great nation. And also, it was a blessing to Egypt and all the other surrounding nations. Joseph could see that there was more to this than his own personal discomfort. There was more than the injustices and the slavery and the defamation and these hardships that he'd endured. He saw that God was doing something bigger. And he was protecting this family that would become the special nation, preventing them from starving to death before they could even get started. It wasn't a purpose he chose, but he willingly accepted it. And actually, there was even more to God's purpose than he knew. He had no idea how the story of God's special nation would unfold. He knew nothing of Moses, of Joshua, the judges, David, the prophets, of Jesus, ultimately, that would come from this nation. Isn't that true of our purpose, too? Sometimes we get a little glimpse of what God's doing in the upper story of our lives, but I doubt whether any of us really fully understand our purpose this side of eternity. We may have a sense of it, we may not. And even if we do, I'm sure there's more to it than we realize. The point is, our lives do have purpose. Whether we see it or understand it or not, God has a purpose for our story as part of his story. Your life isn't meaningless. Joseph's response and perspective show two important choices that he made. One was the choice of humility. He says, "Am I in the place of God?" He admits there's more to the story than he could know or understand. And the other one is the choice of forgiveness. He was kind. He provided comfort and generosity for his brothers, completely the opposite of bitterness and revenge. Joseph's story gives us confidence that God's story is unthwartable. I love that word. Had to slip it in. It's unthwartable. God's purpose is unstoppable. God will build his nation. He will accomplish his purposes. We're going to see his story unfold as we continue to go through the story together. God could have found easier, quicker ways to reconcile Joseph to his brothers. And he could have freed Joseph from his captors, couldn't he? He could have caused Joseph to be exonerated when he was falsely accused of sexual assault. God could have prevented the famine. But God had a bigger plan for Joseph as part of his story. Joseph sure didn't choose the course of his life, and it definitely wasn't easy or fun. But as he looked back, he certainly took pride in how God's story had played out in his life story. Very few of us chart a course when we're young and follow it through to our graves. Most of us have lives with unexpected twists and turns. Craig and I definitely have had. Are we frustrated by them? Are we disappointed, angry, resentful? Or do we trust that God has purpose in them? So what's happening in your lower story now that causes you to question, is God with me? Is God going to rescue me? Where's God's favor and wisdom when I need it? Does my life really have meaning or purpose? So if the worship team would come back up, I want you to close your eyes for a moment. Is there somewhere in your life where you can really see that God has moved? You can look back and see, wow, God, I wouldn't have planned that. I wouldn't have orchestrated that. I wouldn't have wanted that. I wouldn't have chosen that. But you've used it for good. And I can see that you had a bigger purpose. And then are there places in your life where you currently are enduring things that you would not want or choose? And it just feels like it's impossible. I'm in a situation I can't get out of. And maybe you have different areas of your life, and some of them you can see God's hand and some of them you can't. And I encourage you to bring all those before God. And God, as we lift these before you, we want to remember the times we've seen you come through for us. We want to look at Joseph's story and see how you came through for him. And we want to hold on to hope. We want to be a people who trust you so that when we are in those difficult and dark times, those times that seem hopeless, those times where nothing seems to be working out or going right and we wonder where you are, we want to hold on to hope that you are bigger and you have purpose for each and every one of us, that you're not absent. You love us, you're with us, you're guiding us, you're helping us, whether we can see it or not. Make us a people who pursue you and hope in you. In Jesus' name, amen.